So we'll have a short break for a few minutes, and Christopher will come and give the evening talk. I know that for some of you it's a bit cold, and but it's simply impossible to have it inside. Last night we had 200 people here, and it's even worse inside without air and stuffy. So if you see somebody next to you freezing and suffering, please give them a shawl, a cloak, a hug, a cuddle. Any announcements there? Big carriages for others of you who are here. Okay. All right. Thank you, sir. Let's just have a quiet minute together. One of those who had the delight, and I think rather the privilege as well, of spending rather a lot of time in the East, primarily India and Thailand, where I was for 10 years, that in some 25 years now of returning back to the West, that there is a continual and important exploration going on of deep teaching, profound practices. And one of the influences which I've been noticing, and possibly and hopefully you yourselves as well, that we do need, and it's rather important, a genuine diversity of exploration and communication of teachings and practices which will in real terms help to wake up our life, to go deep into ourselves, and to discover many things in life which we don't see, don't recognize, are rather blind to. And in the whole world of mind, body, environment, use of resources, there is a great deal for you and I to learn about. And one area which I think is very important is the area of the art. There is a clear and very visible Eastern tradition of the arts, and those of you who have ever been to the East, to Thailand, the Sukhothai period, to the caves of Ajanta in India, to Angkor Wat in Cambodia, to Indonesia and Borobudur, and many other places, tremendous explosions in history of profound and deep communicative art which speaks to us and tells us of things. And there's a great tradition of this, Buddhist tradition, Eastern traditions there. And one of my small but heartfelt wishes, that in the passage of time, we, that is you and I and others, will find fresh ways of exploring depths of awareness and to use the arts as a means, as a vehicle for communication, so that we don't have to rely upon, much as I love it, the arts of the East, of Buddha images and temples and statues, but to find the new forms there. And just well, here I'm just talking with a good friend, Lee, and I have here, which a rather large plastic bag. And a day two ago, I was given a rather lovely gift. And before I start talking on the theme, I'm rather keen to show it to you, and to, you'll get the connection with it when I put my hat on, and then I'll show you the gift, and you'll see. She's also, and I wear this a lot, I have to say. In fact, I wear it most of the time. I haven't worn it in bed yet, but you never know. Right. So, the hat was given to me by Lee, by the same person. So I sent a photograph. So, this is what I received. Don't go away. Just something? Isn't it just something? Am I one person or two? Lovely. As you can tell, it's a few months ago. The beard was longer. My daughter said to me, "Dad, you're looking more like Father Christmas." You know, I don't mind looking like, you know, I flew in from LA or a priest or something, but not Father Christmas. Anyway, here we are. Thank you, Lee. Very, very kind. This is Lee, the shawl, sitting here. And one of the aspects, just in the communication with regard to the art, do think in our looking, in our perceptions, in this case with our eyes or with our ears, and I understand we might have some music a little bit later on in the evening. It's something which requires our care and... oh yes, I'm sorry. Already forgot. I do say that with regard to life and our capacity as human beings to be creative, to use the wonders of our imagination, to express ourselves, that the arts is a great vehicle. And this evening, later on, I understand that we have some musicians here and we can have some music later on. And in the very listening, or in the very seeing itself, the greatest respect that we can give is to bring the fullness of interest, the fullness of care and attention to what we see, to what we hear. And maybe through that fullness of interest and attention, we then get touched, and something touches us deeply. And quite often, we see art, and we think, how much is it worth? We see art, and we say, oh, that was nice, that was interesting, or I don't make sense of that, I don't understand that. We haven't seen it. We haven't seen it. It requires, and just looking, just speaking of one person here, Lee, who works a great deal with the colour, or the non-colour, we might say, of black. One looks initially at this large works of art that she's making and just sees black. But then one looks a little closer and looks a little bit longer. And then one sees much, much more. It begins to stand out. It begins to be much more clear, and something, oh, starts to come through. In some way or other, can we approach our inner life and our life in the same kind of way? Much more fullness of interest, fullness of care to the ordinary and the everyday, from brushing our teeth to going to the toilet to having a conversation with somebody, to work, to study, to nature. Hey, this is our life. I don't need somebody else to be my guru and tell me about how valuable it is to be awake. Life should be telling us this. Life should be hopefully revealing to us, wait, this is a short journey on this existence. Let's not blow it. Let's not go through a daydream. Let's not, as we used to say a few years ago, get, how many people would get to the end of their life and say at the end of their life, I wish I'd spent more time in the office. So in bringing more consciousness and more care and interest in that, we'll see more, we'll discover more. I remember one of the monks, I was in the monastery at Wat Suan Mok. Mok means moksha, liberation. Suan is garden, the monastery of the garden of liberation. And there was a great deal of art taking place. One of the monks, who great love for Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of the great reformers of the tradition in Thailand, and the monk just sat and looked, and he wasn't an artist, and he just sat, and then he got a pen, a marker, one of these markers, sheets of paper, and he did these spontaneous, amazing drawings of the teacher, one after the other. He was surprised in himself where it came from. But it was just in his silence as a monk, in his stillness, in his fullness of attention, there wasn't anything filtering. And it just came through. And again, he hesitated to show. And we say, oh, come on. Because we could see him doing it. Come on, let's have a look. And then it goes from the private arena, it goes to the public. The attention and the beautiful fruits of it is then shared with others. I just had the joy of sharing this with you. It's shared with others. It enters into the community of life. It's no longer private. So if you and I can live with, as much as we can, with the fullness of attention, taking real interest to the ordinary and the everyday, finding some moments of silence and stillness, who knows what deep and profound and beautiful things can flower through us for the community of life. That's what being awake is about. I don't know if sometimes in day-to-day life you're not an unusual thing. Sometimes we say, I can't make up my mind. And we wonder how on earth we got ourselves into a situation in life where we say to ourselves, shall I do this or shall I do that? And in Dharma language, we're in a duality. There is a kind of split inside of ourselves. We don't know why I've got this split, but the split inside of myself is, I could do this at this time in my life, or I could do that. And we just can't decide. So then, we've got a split mind, we've got thoughts one direction, thoughts in the other, and then we said, how am I going to resolve this? How am I going to come to an answer? It could be about anything. So then, we might go and seek out our friends. We say to our friends, you know, I just can't make up my mind. Shall I go after this job? Shall I move house? Shall I go to India? Shall I start this relationship? Shall I end this relationship? Whatever, you know. And there's many more of them around. So we go to our friends, who will quite frequently start off with the mantra, if I were you, oh no. And, or, they will then say, you should do this. If I were you, I really would do this. Then you go to somebody else. And they say, no, no, no. And we practically go to anybody to try to get an answer. Well, practically anybody but our parents, you know, but anybody but them. And we'll go in and try to get... And sometimes somebody will say to us, well, I wouldn't do either of those two things. Have you thought about... Oh, no. I've now gone from two persons inside to three. So then we try to look inside, and we're still moving, as it were, from up above. But I'll give you a story. It's a true story. A friend of mine had, in fact, had been to, this is years ago, had been to Pune. Some of you know through Osho in the ashram. And she had come back, and she was working in one of our sister Dharma centers, in a Buddhist retreat center, in Austria, in fact. And while in this place, some various people were coming and going, and this guy who was on the retreat had seen in Pune a photograph of her. That's all, in a group, just some sannyasins together, you know, in a kind of group photograph, you know, being shown in a coffee shop. He saw this woman, so just a photograph, and he said he felt totally in love with her just based on the photograph. And nobody knew who she was, her name, etc. Just in a group picture. He walks into this retreat center. Who's on the staff? The woman in the photograph. Poh. She really, maybe because of his enthusiasm, I'm not sure, but she really connected with him. One small problem. You know what it is. She'd been in a good relationship for several years. Now what does she do? Does she stay with the man she's been with for several years? Or this strong heart, and then the favorite word coming in, cosmic connection. Oh. When that happens, watch out. What does she do? And then she says, so I heard about all this from her and from the guy who was sitting the retreat. And then comes, Christopher, can you help me? Etc. I just don't know what to do. My heart says I'm in a good relationship. Why do I want to throw it away? When I could, when this guy is so kind, he's so loving, we have so much in common, there's a connection, cosmic connection. The outcome, I don't say it's an answer. The outcome was, firstly, where are the feelings coming from? And sometimes the thought is has indecision in it, but the thought requires some feelings, and the feelings, one way and the other, keep jumping up with all the comparing that goes on. Beneath the feelings, what's going on? There's some kind of contact with a picture, with an image. Put together the contact, the feeling, the thought, there's a loop. And the good person couldn't see outside the loop. I said, you have to keep going to the feeling. Forget the story. Forget your imagination. Touch the deepest place that you can feel in yourself. See if you can rest in that. See what comes through for you. What came through, and to her credit, was what she decided was she would have to step out of both men's lives. Not easy, rather brave. To give herself some space from the passion around the two men that she was feeling, or the trust in the relationship and the potential for the new one. The stepping out from that gave her some time and space. And she just went off for a few weeks. Out of that came the decision. I don't know, you all want to answer. I'm not going to give you. So sometimes with the interest and the kind of the point that I'm trying to make with this is that sometimes the interest, the deep interest that we have, is, as we were listening today with Ellie today, is not to feel fragmented. The deep journey of the human being is the deep, profound wish for wholeness. It's a deep yearning, a deep love, and you and I love it in the sense of wholeness with things. And we don't like fragmentation. We don't like, in Dharma language, the duality of division. We don't like to feel it inwardly, because it can go from uncertainty, a dilemma, indecision, conflict, and a complete inner collapse of what to do. And I've listened to many rather painful stories of that kind of movement. And the deep yearning is for resolution, is for wholeness and clarity. In the same way, it applies from the inner to the outer. And what happens for us with regard from the inner to the outer is when there is a sense of separation, once that's fixed, all problems, so-called, can arise from the sense of the self and the other, whoever it may be. When I have a sense of other as a problem or as a threat, one thing I can say, and I hope all of you will remember this with good heart, if I have a sense of other as a problem and as a threat, others are not who I think they are. When there is fragmentation and conflict, and there is a sense of other, either the individual, or blame, rage against, negativity towards, the other is not who I think they are. And we, when we're on the receiving end, we are not who he or she or they think we are. And the terrible tragedy of human existence is we believe in what we think. We believe what we think is who they are. And it's an extraordinary thing to challenge the position, to question it. Every argument, every conflict, every war has with it the view of other. And sometimes it goes from the particular to the general. I'll give you a family story here. I have a daughter, Nishona. She's 22 years of age. My father, beautiful, I'd say, of course. And she was going out with the father of her young son, is English, but from family from the West Indies, from the Caribbean. Nice guy. He's in England we call it, he's a bouncer. Do you know what a bouncer is? The bouncer is the guy that stands outside the nightclub with a suit. You know, you've got loads of them around here. There's a whole industry. So he's a bouncer outside the nightclubs in Torquay. I said, what a fantastic job. Standing out there doing standing meditation from about 9 in the evening till 1 or 2 in the morning, giving metta, giving loving kindness to all those who are coming in and out. I said, what? I said, this is a bodhisattva job. It is really, So anyway, he didn't last in terms of my daughter. Oh, all things must stop now. This has been at the top of the pops for more than 1,000 years. Okay, wonderful. So I was talking about my beloved daughter. So my daughter, God bless her, she was going out with an Afro-American. It's a story to illustrate how we can go from the particular, quickly, the sense of other, to the general. You'll see what I mean in a minute. So, she was going out with him for about 6 months. And then, coincidentally, she met outside one of the local shops his previous partner, with whom he has a 2-year-old child. And the previous partner said to my daughter, his name's Sean, the guy, "I'm so glad that Sean came back to me." And my daughter went, "What?" And she said, "Yes. We've been back together for a few months." And my daughter said, "What? He's with me." So the two women went and had a coffee together. Well, actually my daughter doesn't drink coffee, but you know what I mean. Went and then they started comparing dates. So he'd said to the other woman, "I'm going off to London for the weekend to watch Arsenal play in a football match." "Oh, nice. Enjoy yourself." In fact, he was in a hotel on the beach with my daughter. He was doing this. Months. It takes some organizing. So she said to him, and he's an Afro-American living in England for 12 or 13 years, my daughter said to him, "You're history." And he was, worked out. So she was relating all this to me. And because of the first situation, within a similar, she said to me, I was surprised, I heard it, she said to me, "Wow, Dad, these black guys, they're all the same." I said to her, "A little racist are we today, darling?" And she said, "You're right, Dad. Men, they're all the same." I said, "Yeah, I could agree with that." Look, the women are clapping. The men are rather quiet. So, sometimes, as I say, and the serious point, and the Buddha speaks of this quite a lot, we pick out a person, we focus on him or her, and we identify them in a particular way. In the moment of doing that, he or she becomes the other. "He or she did this to me." When the mind doesn't have space in it, doesn't have a bigger sense in it, from the particular, it will have to generalize. And it would go from the individual or certain individuals to the generality of the other. The mind hasn't got the space to keep it. This is one person's behavior. And then from that, the sweeping brush, and we then all get tarred with the same brush in some way or other, or certain kinds of people. And it takes an inner clarity with us not to make the serious error of perception in which we take some features and we ascribe them in a general way. My goodness me, there's no community in the world that knows this better than I know, than you know it. You know what I'm talking about. And how easily, if this isn't clear and resolved inside of ourselves, how easy it keeps happening again and again and again. We can't actually see the people. At the moment, currently in the United Kingdom, it is taking place, the other, around the word refugees and asylum seekers. So highly politicized, we can't see, hey, these people are refugees. They are needing to get away from terrible situations. These people are seeking asylum or whatever. They end up as a category, or they're dangerous, or they're going to take our jobs, or they're going to affect our lives. We can't see the person anymore. And this is the tragedy of the media, that in its construct, in its writing, it claims it's reflecting reality. It's creating the construct to make a reality for us. That's why we've got to really hear each other, really listen to each other, really connect inwardly and outwardly, to really sense in the communication, is it connection or is it other? And these teachings and these practices is about the connection element and the power and the authority of it. Sometimes in Dharma teachings and explorations, issues and areas of love, which we touched upon today. And if I may say here, during our days here, we've had some wonderful group discussions and meetings. And one of the lovely things about coming to Israel, which I really appreciate very much, is that in this country you can speak your heart and speak your mind. And just as we had yesterday evening in the meeting, you know, people just speaking up and speaking out, and I think it's important and healthy and kind of liberated awareness. It isn't like that everywhere on this earth. It really isn't that easy in many, many places. And being one of those who travel a lot, some of you may be a little bit surprised to hear this, one of the most difficult places for truly free speech is in the United States. That's my experience. I go to four continents in the year. For all the rhetoric of democracy and freedom, down there on the ground level, not quite the rhetoric and the reality there. And sometimes, in some places, in the speaking up and the speaking out, that sometimes there's a climate and a culture that if one does, one's being rude or judgmental or negative or whatever. And the thing is, and then as I get sometimes in the United States, no, one speaks up and speaks out, one gets the message back, don't do it. To give you a small example, another small example, I referred this a year or two ago. After 9/11, I was asked to write a book on transforming our terror, and for a New York publisher. I wrote the book, and I think you would all agree, in this world that we live in, how interconnected we all are. The bottom line is, you and I have, all of us as human beings, have much more in common than our differences. Never let us forget, we have much more in common than our differences. We need to listen to each other. So part of the book was an endeavor to reflect what we have in common. In this particular example that I gave, it was that parents, and some of you will know from the nightmare and the obscenities that have been inflicted on your own community, that parents lost their son in the Twin Towers, and the family had made a request to the United States government, which is what I was quoting, please do not use aeroplanes to inflict the same pain and suffering on others as those aeroplanes which the suicide terrorists had used on the Twin Towers. Please do not do the same. In Afghanistan, Americans bombed Afghanistan. On the front page of an English Sunday newspaper was a picture of a husband and all of his children dead on the bed after bombing of a suburb in northern Kabul. And the mother came home and she said, in her grief and in her terrible sorrow, how could this be done? Surely we had to find some other way to resolve our differences. The New York publisher wanted me to cut out all the stories of India, Afghanistan, my visits to Israel, my visits to the Palestine, and therefore transforming our terror was exclusively kept to the sufferings of the US citizens. I said, I'm not going to do it. No, absolutely no chance. No chance. I ended up meeting with the owner of the publishing house in London on coming back from India. And they said to me, they said, but Christopher, I said, because I'm not changing, they said, Christopher, but we're not planning to publish this book in Hebrew or in Arabic. Why are you so bothered? They couldn't understand the commonality of the suffering that American citizens experience, that Madrid experience citizens experience, that Israeli citizens experience, that Palestinian citizens or Afghani or wherever. The suffering is intensely in common. So in the end I had to give the ultimatum. All or nothing. Or you publish it and you don't touch it, or you get, I cease all cooperation. You can take me to the courts because they give me the advance, blah, blah, blah. And after a week or two, they climb down. They put it in. And I just use it as a small example out there in the world, in our own life, how easy the fragmentation, either from within, I can't make up my mind, or from without, inner to the outer, the sense of other makes the problem. And we've got to dig deep, get underneath it, get behind it, look out of the box, as I frequently say. I'm just coming to a conclusion in talking with you here. In the daily life circumstances, if we're taking greater care with this, for those of you who have been unfortunate enough to have to go to London, and you've travelled on the underground, there's an incredible mantra at most underground railway stations as you get off the train. You got it. Mind the gap. I didn't realize that the London Underground authorities had such profound insight into the nature of reality. I was so impressed. Mind the gap. And if you forget this, try and find a sponsor. Take a flight to London. Take the train in, get on the underground for a few stops, just to get the great teaching from London Underground Railway authorities to remind you to mind the gap. Because once the gap is there, that means duality in Dharma language. Anything can happen. And then one says, but what's truth in Dharma? What is truth? Very deep, beautiful question. What is truth? And I think sometimes our poets, with language, kind of get us close to it. What's truth? And in Dharma teaching, it has an extraordinary function, because quite often you and I, we rather sadly have been told what truth is. We get it from the religion. This is the truth, you believe it or you don't, and with the consequences that we would be told. We'll get it from our philosophers, we'll get it from the educators, we'll get it from science, or whatever it might be. And sometimes all the argument that goes on over it is in the language. But in Dharma, we're not concerned with truth as a view, we're not concerned with it as a set of opinions. In Dharma, truth is that which dissolves the gap. Truth is that which collapses the fragmentation. When it does that, truth has landed. It's not a formula. It's not something in the hands of the religious who can go and organize it. It's not something in the hands of the politicians, which we know that already, and then they can tell us what it is. It's something which is not of the words, but what it does when it touches home, which is us, when it touches home, it dissolves the division, it dissolves the fragmentation, it finishes the gap. The truth is the liberator. Sometimes we say to ourselves, God, I wish I could find somebody who could enlighten me. Wouldn't it be nice? Just, it'd be lovely. And sometimes people write to Christopher and they say, Christopher, you have to come and meet. And this is regular. You have to come to meet. Very kind. I like to hear these messages. This person is enlightening people every night, and it's only $50 a head. No, it's a bad joke, sorry. This person is enlightening people every night, and so you don't have to do all this meditation, you don't have to concern with all these spiritual practices and working on yourself. Just go, you get a huge big darshan, which means a big meeting with this person, and he or she, mostly men, isn't it, I have to say, most would blow your mind, etc. If it was the case that one human being can really enlighten others, I think everybody should get there as quickly as possible, because someone can do it for us. It would save a lot of effort. You think, don't have to sit on the cushion anymore. It's a blessing in itself. But it's not the case. If you and I say, oh, I can only do it myself, this is sometimes what the Buddhists come out with. So where is the truth inside? Where am I? Where? Where is it? Etc. And my mother came to see me years ago when I was a monk in the hotel. She said, what's meditation? What's all this meditation about? And I said, seeing is looking, and looking into yourself. And we're sitting in the hotel foyer with all the tourists around in the middle of Bangkok. So she said, well, teach me now. So there's me, the monk in the hotel in the foyer on the sofa, sitting there. So I sit cross-legged, I'm used to it. My mother's sitting there. And so I said, close your eyes, Mum, and look within. And so sometimes I just look at my eyes. And by this time, there's a whole circle of tourists standing around watching this little show. I see my mother staring at me. I just love it. Chris, calls me Chris. Chris, I can't see anything. Brilliant, Mum, you're enlightened. Right. So sometimes we want to have a kind of set view, set language, a set opinion, a set standpoint. The beautiful thing about truth is it can't be organized. It can't be put into a set of words. It can't be constructed and sold and proclaimed. But human beings, sometimes our struggle with the language, but that which ends the fragmentation, dissolves the duality, sees through, so to speak, the separateness and the falsity of it. When that happens for us, then truth has touched. And it opens up our life, and we can feel it, and we can appreciate it, and been touched with something, and we feel awake and alert, and we feel a certain kind of vibration with life, and a sense of universe opening itself up. We sense it, and we love it. And out of that comes something beautiful. And what's extraordinary about when something beautiful comes out of us, the I can't really make a claim over it. If a person was to come up to you, because something beautiful is coming out, and the person says, you know something, I'm an incredibly loving person. I'm full of compassion. I'm so generous. I give all day. I'm friendly to everybody. There's nothing I wouldn't do for you all, etc. If you and I hear that from somebody, bye. It's something that makes us feel distinctly uncomfortable with the I connecting with love, compassion, generosity. It feels uncomfortable even to say, I'm very loving. Do you know, I've given up a cafe latte tonight to come and talk to you. Whatever. The I, with giving, feels uncomfortable. And similarly, if you and I, we might be hearing good things about a person, but if he or she keeps saying, I, even good things, I am enlightened, I am realized, I have discovered the truth, I know what it is, I am going to help you, I am going to teach you, God help us. So, love, care, giving, expression is not for the world of ego. Understand? It's not for the I. So naturally you feel rather uncomfortable about it. We may meet people, and we do say, I would say, I meet people, I say, gosh, what a loving person this is. What a generous person is, what a kind person is, isn't it? And it's lovely to be in the touch, in the contact, in the communication with such people. But if that person was using of themselves the description that I use of them, loving, kind and good, I'd go, whoa, wait a minute. It's not for the I. And the Dharma of the Buddha is frequently referred to as a not I teaching. Beautiful. Just beautiful. See, the fireworks are going off. They're just celebrating the teaching, you see. That could be interpreted in a very egotistical way. I know. Etc. So, just in conclusion, in the as we're coming more towards the closure, that we have some groups again tomorrow, do we? In the morning, I think, Iran? Yeah? And, of course, the sitting meditations as well there. And we've been having groups, the whole variety of various themes about what is purpose in life and around clinging and direction in life and action and our relationship to results and connection and relationships, etc. And it's been a delight, formally, informally, chatting, talking and listening to many of you. And I had an idea for one of the groups tomorrow morning. Three things. Possibly one of the three will have some interest for you. And these are the three: love, sex, and dharma. Hey? Sometimes known as the triple gem. No. Very bad joke. I'm sorry. So we have four or five teachers, women and men, teaching, giving the groups. During tomorrow morning, we'll be speaking for a minute or two in front of those who are able to come about the topic and the theme. This is the one I'll do, and the other teachers will be contributing. And I think we need... I was just teaching in Germany last week in fact, and we had a Christian minister from Berlin, and at the end of the days together, you know, and including, you know, like we're having this evening and explorations, she said, you know, Christopher, to the whole group, she said, Christopher, I just loved being here. It's the first time I've ever stepped outside of my tradition to come and listen to you, because a good friend of mine is practically, who's a Christian minister in Berlin, has converted his church into a kind of Dharma center, not with great approval, I must say, from the Christian authorities, but he's done it. And she said, but I feel a little bit sad. And she said, the reason I feel a little bit sad, she says, because I've realized just how far away we in the Christian church have come from the real teachings of Jesus. How far away we have come. Because listening to you and listening into the small groups, etc., she said a few times she thought, this is how Jesus must have been working. I'm just a little fish. You know, he and the Buddha and many, and Abraham, they're the big ones, the big fish. I'm just, you know, down in the middle. But she said, she made me realize how the teachings and the explorations must have been taking place 2,000 years ago. Just men and women listening together, talking together, looking into things together, recognizing the importance of love and awareness and salvation or liberation or kingdom of heaven or whatever we want to call it. I felt a little bit sad how far the church has got itself lost in its dogma. I think we, together, as these evenings have shown, in respecting our own experience and exploring and looking together, and you might, people ask me, Christopher, do you have a mantra? Of course I've got a mantra. It's a great mantra. It's very simple. Have fun and change the world. This is my mantra. It's a much better one than Om Mani Padme Hung, or the Vipassana equivalent of Om My Poor Knees. Have fun, change the world. Thanks for lending an ear.
Om to you all.
Shalom. So, Ryan, we have a few announcements and a few things, isn't it?
Want a moment of silence before?
Pardon? Oh, so, let's have a quiet moment of... thank you. He's a meditator, you can tell. So let's have a silent minute together, and then Iran will make a few announcements. Lovely, thank you. Now, if I may say, with all due respect to the mosques and the synagogues and the temples and the churches, for which can be much inspiration and insight and learning can come, I genuinely feel in a historical way in this beginning of the third millennium that we can offer something different, deeply spiritual, profound, profoundly connected, and which is genuinely, really, perhaps first time or for a long, long time, in which women and men are truly seen as equals. And unfortunately religion, I include Buddhism in this, has not had that kind of vision. It's been terribly dominated from the top down. And I think we as women and men of the earth can really explore a vision with a new direction and a new purpose and a new way, which is really from the very, very beginning completely equal all the way through, women and men. And I know in our communities and in our international networks, roughly the for teachers, for example, male female teachers, roughly about the same. And I think that's just vitally important of what we're trying to share, what we're trying to communicate together as part of a deep, liberating teaching about existence. Good. Thank you very, very much. Lovely to see you all. Great to be here. And here we are.